Blog Talk Radio.
Dog Works Training Centers, professional canine training center in Denver, Colorado, presents Mush, You Huskies, a show about dog-powered sports and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Mush, You Huskies, is part of Twine Group Media and syndicated worldwide on blogtalkradio.com. Here's your host, Dr. Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Mush You Huskies, brought to you by Denver Dog Works and Twine Group Media. I am up here in Alaska, in Willow, Alaska, at our new home, and today we have a very special guest on the line. We have Nancy Cowan. I guess you could call her a sled dog historian. She wrote a book about Doc Lombard called The Training and Racing Journals of Doc and Louise Lombard. And we're going to get right into the interview, but I do want to warn you guys, there are some technical glitches in there. That's the nature of Skype and Blog Talk Radio, so I apologize. But sit back and listen and enjoy the show.
I got into the racing mainly just from a love of working with the dogs, but I was not going to be the world's greatest racer for sure. And it just ended up my contribution to the sport through the New England Sled Dog Club was as publicity director. I began to write a lot of history involved with doing press releases and so forth to get people interested. We had three snowless years that I was publicity director. You learn to write really well when you have three snowless years and you're trying to interest people in races.
And how long ago was this that you were just getting involved into the sport?
That would have been the very early 90s. And what happened was my interest in publishing or in presenting the history just grew and grew. I had already been interested enough to collect, and I had fortunately made friends with a number of the people in New England who really are the greats. And when they were passing on, some of them were cognizant that the history might be lost. And so I became a repository of photographs and memories and all kinds of bits and pieces and of data about sled dog history. And I collected myself. So I searched out where what wasn't given to me. I searched out and found myself.
And in our talks over the last couple of weeks, you are a true historian of the sport. From the sound of it, I mean, you've got information that so few people even know about, and I hope to delve into that a little bit this evening on our conversation. And Michelle, if you're there, just chime in any time if you have any questions or comments. Otherwise, let's get right into this, Nancy. We're going to talk mainly about the Lombards this evening. Let's give a little bit of intro about who they are. I'm sure quite a few mushers know who they are, but I'm sure many of them don't.
Well, Doc and Louise Lombard were a couple. He was a veterinarian that practiced in Massachusetts and lived in Wayland, Mass. And he got into sled dogs. Sled dogs got him into veterinarian school. He won the handicap race in 1930 as an 18-year-old, and that gave him $2,000 to spend on going to vet school. When he finished with vet school, he wanted to get back into dogs, and of course he was friends with people like Eva Brunel Seeley, who owned Chinook Kennels. He already had the acquaintance of many people that, he'd met the Elizabeth Ricker Nansen. He had met Leonard Seppala. When he was a kid, he was only 9 miles from Poland Springs, and he was over there all the time as a child, learning from great people in racing history. When he began his own racing career, he started out in the late 40s with Malamutes, and Louise actually continued racing Malamutes, and she did pretty well. She said she never wanted anybody to have to stand around and wait for her to come in, and they didn't. So she didn't hold the show up, that's for sure, when she raced. But he wasn't satisfied with the speed of Malamutes, so he eventually went all over to completely over to Siberians. When he got had won just about everything there was to win in New England, he wanted to go further afield, and he went to Alaska. And what he found in Alaska absolutely blew him away. The toughest trails he'd ever seen, the toughest competition he'd ever fought against, and dogs, it just blew his mind. The gene pool that he was tapping into at the Alaskan Husky, eventually he switched into having mostly Alaskan Huskies on his team. But one thing that I found really interesting about Doc Lombard was he always studied dogs. And if you look at pictures of Delta and Vixen, two of his famous leaders, one of them was a registered Siberian Husky. The other was an Alaskan Husky. They look like they came from the same litter. It's amazing.
And he truly is a student of the sport. I mean, he kept copious notes. He was probably one of the best informed mushers of the day, and I hope to get into that as well. But tell us a little about his early years. I know you and I have talked a little bit about that, about some of the encumbrances he had to overcome in his early years so he could do this as an adult, etc.
Well, when he started out, it really almost all the neat stories that you've ever seen from Hollywood about the kid and dog, good Lord, they hearken right back to Doc Lombard. He was a little boy. He had 25 cents in his pocket. He bought a puppy his mother forbade him to have, hid it in his grandfather's barn, and pretty soon his grandfather and his aunt heard this puppy crying and eventually convinced him, you got to go, Roland, and tell your mother. She wisely allowed Roland to keep this puppy because this puppy grew up to be the lead dog of the team that led him to that win in 1930 and won the $2,000 for him. But at the same time, this boy was, when he went to school by dog team. Here he is in rural Maine. He grew up in Windham, Maine. As I said, he's only 9 miles from Poland Springs. He's spending every second that he can spend at Leonard Seppala's elbow. When he goes to races, he's watching the best of the Canadian races, Leonard Seppala and the people with the kennels that are beginning to make names for themselves through their dogs in New England. So as Roland grew up, the stories just kept going. I mean, he came home from driving a dog team across the frozen land from school, and here he's got scarlet fever, sick as can be, but drove the team all the way home. His father had to lift him off the sled. The fact that he won with the 1930 race with Bucky must have engendered tons and tons of fictional novels later on about the kid and dog that win the big race. Roland was always a student of what he did. He absolutely loved the dogs, and he studied all the racers to learn from them. When he got into his own kennel, when he was practicing veterinary medicine, he could have his own place and start his own kennel. He studied very, very hard to get back to the dogs that Leonard Seppala had been driving so successfully. They'd been a wonderful, wonderful team that had come early on from Chinook Kennels. Dick Moulton, who in his own right was a wonderful racer, told me it was the fastest dog team he'd ever seen. And when Roland got back into dogs, those great Siberians, they were gone. The breed was not the same. It wasn't, the people had been breeding for show. They'd been breeding for looks on the dogs. And he worked really, really hard to breed back to produce that kind of Siberian, the kind of Siberian that Leonard Seppala had had. This led him through the Siberian Husky Club of America to establish a program called SEP, Siberian Evaluation Performance Program. And all of this effort was designed to put the Siberian back in the game the way it had been originally when it had first been imported from Siberia when it first came out of Alaska and came to New England.
Let me ask you a question there. What year is that that he tried to refine the lines? Is that in the 60s now?
Oh, he started, probably right through, way before that. He started probably from the time that he left Malamutes and went to Siberians. He was working on that. So I would say late 40s. And by the end of the 50s, he had really good Siberians that he was running, that he'd bred. Now, when he got to, in 1958, I believe it was, when he went to Alaska, he was astounded at looking at the quality of the Alaskan Huskies that he was running against and realized that what he was against was a gene pool that was huge, enormous. And that was something that really blew his mind. It was the fact that, he said, here are the best of the best of the best. All these dogs from all these villages, only the best have been taken out of a village. They've been coordinated so that, they pick out the best dogs for the teams were going to go into the races, and they were just absolutely the best of the genetic pool. And the genetic pool was enormous. Comparing that to the genetic pool that he had available in his own kennel, that most of the other Siberian racers had, he was outnumbered. And he called it the numbers game.
I akin it to how people make hot rods. They take, the generic car, and then they get parts from all over the place and make the fastest, best car they can make. And that's kind of what they were doing up in Alaska, is they were just taking little bits and pieces from one dog pool to another dog pool and making the quote-unquote hot rod of sled dogs. Is that right?
Well, not quite. At that point in time, maybe later on, yes. Later on, they began fooling around with what came from what dog yard and so forth. But actually, what they were doing initially was taking the best of the village races to go to the bigger races and taking the best from that and taking the best later on until they got up to the big races, at Anchorage and Fairbanks and so forth. By then, those dogs had been absolutely culled down to the absolute tremendous athletes that were there in Alaska. And there were so many to choose from. I won't say it was accidental because these racers knew what they wanted in dogs, but they didn't have to breed for it. Now, later on, they began to work at that. They really began to work to get something from one dog yard to another dog yard, almost too much. They had to breed, be careful that they weren't crossing up their dog yards too closely. In latter years with the Alaskans. But that's the same problem that the Siberians were dealing with at the time that Doc went to Alaska in the late 50s. So he worked at this, but, it's too simple to say the man just tried to breed a good race dog. He was able to get into the heads of the dogs. I mean, he studied his dogs. He knew dogs so well that temperament and desire in the dog, he had a way of evaluating his dogs to know which ones were going to be, they were going to make it on the team. They were going to be the competitive dogs. So it wasn't just the breeding. It was what was inside the dog's head. Added to that, his training was so careful, he absolutely left nothing to chance. I guess you'd have to say he worked harder than anybody else I can imagine working at the sled dog game. And it paid off.
So let's talk a little bit about the SEP program. That's kind of in existence still a little bit, but, nowadays, and being a Siberian musher my entire time on a dog sled, I don't know anything else. But there's so many people that have a misconception of what a Siberian is supposed to be. You'll walk down the road and see a working Siberian versus a show Siberian. It's an entirely different dog. So you hit on a point there about the SEP program, and I was wondering if you can expand on that a little bit.
Well, the SEP program was never embraced as much as it should have been, because I think that while you had individuals within the show circles who really earnestly wanted the dog to retain its working characteristics, it wasn't unanimous across the show circle. And politically and every otherwise, when you get into any kind of clubs or breeding or whatever, there are going to be people who are present their own opinions and they're strong enough to keep them. And so SEP was not always accepted and given the support it should have been. It was a wonderful program, and they had at the beginning of SEP, they had three key people who were absolutely knew exactly what they should be looking for. Those three key people were, of course, Doc Lombard, Richard Moulton, and Dr. Charlie Belford. So two veterinarians and a man who had driven dogs at Antarctica, driven dogs all his life from the time he was 8 or 9 years old. So these three individuals couldn't have been stronger proponents for the SEP program. Unfortunately, when you're dealing with bloodlines, with show bloodlines, and trying to keep a working balance in, you know, keep the dogs as useful and as capable as they always have been, you're going to run into political interference. And I think that politics really is the big problem with anything to do with the Siberian right now, unfortunately. I can say that because I'm not a show person.
You know, Nancy, there are more politics in the dog show circuit than in the White House, I believe.
Oh, sure,
And I remember back in the day, I had a couple of Siberians that I was attempting to show, and most of the people, if not all, said, "What in the world is that?" You know, because it wasn't the quote-unquote pretty little Siberian, you know, roly-poly type Siberian. He and she looked like working dogs, like you would see, you know, back in the 50s or 60s, and you know, that it's still very prejudiced today when you talk about, you know, what a working line should look like versus a show line, and many of the show dogs can't even perform in harness. It's almost been bred out of them, and that's sad.
I don't know how they would perform, seeing how short-coupled they are. You need a leaf dog. You need a long-legged dog with some tuck-up and got to have a lot of space between its chest and the ground. You need that. It has to be able to move, and on top of that, it's got to have a head for running. It's amazing how Doc worked at that. You know, I have video of him running puppies, and it's very similar to what you see the video coming out of Europe where people are running these hounds, and they're on ATVs or bicycles, and the group of hounds is all going with them, you know, and the dogs are having a wonderful time. That's how Doc started puppies in Wayland. He had 50 acres that he had these trails that looped around. He'd be on an ATV, and every puppy be running along, and then he'd stop the ATV, get off, you know, and it was a love-in. He'd sit down on the ground, the puppies would mob him, and everybody's getting patted, and he's watching all the time to see which ones are tired, which ones are winded, give everybody a little space, and he's back on the ATV, and off they all take again. You know, it's very, very similar to what I see today, where in Europe they're taking these groups of dogs, or even Buddy Streeper, you know, when he's running his dogs. They run, and they run for pleasure, and that is what Doc always tried to work into his dog's teams.
The free-running training is so beneficial to a dog team, and most mushers have that a little bit in their training programs as we speak. So let's talk a little bit about Laconia and how that came about, and you know, those sorts of things that lead up to heading up to Alaska.
Okay, well, Laconia started out as a first as a point-to-point. In other words, the racers would go from town to town. They could do this at the time in the 20s because the roads were not plowed. They were snow-rolled, and this was great for anybody that had a cutter with a team of horses or something, because you could get terrific speeds. And same thing with dog teams. You know, you could get really good roads, so you had nice trails for going cross country. You didn't have to break trail or anything like that. It was all snow rolled roads. In 1930, Laconia had evolved by then into a race taking place in a particular town, a center, which pulled in lots of spectators, lots of teams coming. But there was something going on. The going on part was that the major kennels did not want to be out of the winning. And they were being trounced by really good teams that were coming down from Canada. So they worked out something called a handicap system, and anybody that knows anything about racehorses knows what a handicap system is. So a handicap, if you raced a year and you came in at a certain place, you were given a handicap rating, and that's what happened with Doc Lombard. He was 16, 17 years old. He got his own dogs together, led by this Cocker Spaniel Bucky and his aunt Bertha's German Shepherd Rinzo, and a couple other dogs from a friend of his, put this team together in 1929, and he didn't do too well. He did okay, and everybody said, what a great kid, you know, oh, come back next year and so forth. But he got a handicap rating. When he came back next year, he came back with Rinzo and Bucky leading and another dog that had some spunk to it and two Siberians from Leonard Seppala. The two Siberians from Leonard Seppala were speedy dogs, but they fought, and the Eskimo that had come down from Alaska with Leonard to handle said, if you don't get rid of those two white dogs, I quit going back to Alaska. So Leonard led them to Roland. What else to do with him? So Roland had a plan. Again, these guys really think like dogs. They know what they're doing. He took the Siberians back home and one at a time brought them into the kitchen where Bucky was. Now, this was Bucky's kitchen, and he may have been a farm cocker, but, you know, it was his kitchen. And he impressed each Siberian one at a time with, I'm top dog here. Roland didn't have any problem with fights in his dog team. Now he had a really speedy team. So combined with the handicap, he did wonderfully. He took first prize with the handicap. That's what got him the $2,000. Now, day money was won every day by Emile Saint-Godard, who'd come down with his Canadian hounds. But that was okay. The Canadians wanted the money. They didn't care about the prestige. The handicap system eventually got done away with. But that $2,000 was Doc's start, and, of course, that started the reputation. Now, when he came back and started racing, he didn't do as well at Laconia as other people, for instance, Charlie Belford and Dick Moulton would do. Laconia was not that great a trail compared to the trails that he liked to have. And if he found something wrong with the trail when he got to Laconia, he wouldn't race. He would just pull out. I don't like the trail. And, you know, Charlie Belford had told me this had happened on more than one occasion. However, he had won consistently and won a lot of New York races and on up some of the Eastern Canadian races. He had a real good record behind him when he went to out to Alaska. He didn't come in first, but he did impress the Alaskans with the speed of his dog team. They said that if the race had gone 4 days, he probably would have won because they got better each one of the 3 days of the races. So that he was actually gaining. When he came back in 1959 and then in 1960 and so forth, he had learned the game well enough in Alaska that he began to win. And then it was just a matter of history. I mean, he just went on and on and on. He was won Anchorage, he won Tokyo, he won the world championship. You know, he was dual champion, I think 3 or 4 years that he was dual champion.
With his own dogs at this point. He wasn't using other dogs at this point, was he?
He was using Siberians, and he began to mix in the Alaskans more and more. And eventually he was pretty much almost all Alaskan.
Was he bringing them back
to
New England?
He was. He was the person who really introduced the Alaskan Husky to the lower 48. And not only that, when he got back, he starts telling Keith Breyer, Dick Moulton, and Charlie Belford, and all these people about, you know, and Gene Breyer, you know, about these fabulous dogs in Alaska. So pretty soon, this whole crowd, a contingency of New Englanders is going up there. And the exchange of dogs started with Doc Lombard and just exploded right there, bringing Alaskans down to New England to breed into the kennels here.
So let's talk a little bit about your book that you wrote or edited. I don't know what the proper word is for that, the training journals of the Lombards. Tell us a little bit about that, because that is an absolutely fascinating reference book for any musher.
Well, when Louise was faced with giving up the kennels, the Igloopak kennel grounds, the kennel grounds have been sold to the federal government, because here you have 50 pristine acres within stone's throw of Boston with a swamp and woods, and you know, it was amazing, this wild area that Doc and Louise had bought in 1938 was a summer camp, and they made their home there. The property, the federal government knew it was so valuable, they wanted it as a teaching spot for forestry and so forth. And Doc and Louise were very happy about that, but then Doc died, and Louise had intended to stay there the rest of her life because that had been the agreement in the sale. Her son was killed there in a tragic accident on an ATV, and she couldn't stand to stay there. So when she began to get ready to leave the property, she had the repository of, you know, 30 years of trophies, 30 years of dog records, 30 years of training journals, 30 years of, you know, 30, 40 years of everything. And she and Doc had enjoyed the historical stuff that I had been writing in Team and Trail. And she had asked for me to write the obituary in Mushing Magazine, which I did. She was very pleased with that. So she knew she wanted the history to continue, and she gifted me with all of these, you know, this odds and ends boxes and boxes. I went down several times, came back with a carload, never knowing exactly what it was that I was coming back with sometimes. When I started to sort everything out, here were all these journals, and some of the things were written into these ubiquitous date books that drug companies give you, you know, would give doctors or veterinarians and so forth. So a lot of the Alaskan stuff or the racing stuff ended up being in these little pseudo leather bound volumes, and then the actual training when they started in the fall and so forth was in mostly in steno books, and they've been kept absolutely religiously by both Doc and Louise. They had written every time they'd had a team in harness. They had written down what team was in harness. They had written down if there was an event, what had happened. You know, all this was totally everything. They recorded everything. And to the point that it was hard to tell who was writing it. Their writing was very similar. And actually, Doc was practicing veterinary medicine a lot of the time. So Louise did a tremendous amount of the training, and she kept the records too, so just as he did. So when I piled all these books up, I started pulling them out of this corner of a box and that corner of a box and started putting together what I had. It was amazing. I did have 17 missing years, and I was very sorry that I had that. But the other thing that Louise had given me was a box of letters that Doc had sent to her when she could not go to Alaska and he had written home. And this filled in an awful lot of blanks for me. So what I did was I began to reproduce these journals. When I piled them up, there was a pile, you know, almost 3 feet high. Started to transcribe those and also fill in some of the missing parts with some of the things, the extraneous papers that were also in these boxes of things I'd brought back, where he might have a listing of dogs and so forth. I've tried to flesh it out with a little bit of history about the couple, so that people would know exactly what was going on and what was happening with this pair of people. It never occurred to me that actually what Louise's biggest fear was that Doc would be forgotten. That didn't ever occur to me that that could actually happen. Now, I'm 6 years down the road from writing this, and I'm beginning to realize This is terrible. It's awful when new people come in. They don't really even know about who Doc Lombard was and what he accomplished. Just the fact of how he did things, that alone should be such a wonderful path for anybody to follow. And to read the training journals and to realize the care that he took in setting up every training sequence of teams was always different. It never was the same from one time to the next. There always was a subtle change, dogs being put in different positions, dogs being switched around, tested in different ways. And they're very carefully recording the temperature and the humidity and the weather conditions and any events that happened with the dogs. I mean, the information was tremendous.
And with that, Nancy, what's fascinating about that, it was all handwritten. You know, nowadays, if you have a GPS in your hand, it has all that information right there on the screen. You know, the temperature and the altitude and, you know, all of that. It'll have it right there on the screen. But these meticulous notes that this couple was keeping is just amazing.
I can only imagine.
I love
looking at what the relative humidity was and seeing what effect that had on the dogs.
Right.
Or there were certain things in which certain times that he would not train. One of them was icy conditions. He would not run his dogs on frozen grit. Absolutely avoided that, and he wouldn't race on it if he could avoid it, because that tore feet up too badly. The cost in broken toenails and torn pads was just too great, and the injuries to the foot and so forth. He wouldn't take those risks. So there were certain things that, you know, he would note in there, didn't run, icy or whatever. The one thing that you have to pick up from this book, the training journals all compiled together, if you don't pick up anything else, is the amount of dedication that both Louise and Roland showed to him winning. Now, if you have a really, really strong goal, you know, a clear goal on what you want to accomplish and you want to do this and you know you've got to work really hard to do it, that's one thing. But to absolutely, without letting down your guard one moment of one day, to be dedicated totally, 100% towards that goal, that is a rare thing to find in people. Most people cannot sustain that over the decades that this couple did. And at the same time, this man was the most wonderful sportsman, the most total gentleman. And Louise, who worked side by side with him, always cognizant that if there was someone on the outside of the circle, to make sure that that person felt welcomed. It's amazing. People were never turned away if they showed up at Igloo Pack. You know, he would have seated at his table the greatest racers of the time, you know, and if somebody that was a newbie walked up, oh, come on in, join us, have a seat.
And that, again, is something they don't do today. So many cliques these days that, we don't know you, or, you know, such and such. And that's so unfortunate, because this is a camaraderie that should be harnessed, pardon the pun, versus shunned away. Do you know, I'm sure he is, but is he in the Mushers Hall of Fame?
Gosh, I don't know. You know, what's always astounded me, Robert, is that nobody's written a biography. So I guess I better get to work, huh?
It's time to get to work.
I thought one of the things that had held me up for a couple of years doing this is I was waiting for somebody to write a biography, and I thought, great, you know, I want someone to step forward, write the biography, then I'll do the training and racing journals and so forth. That didn't happen. It did not happen. It hasn't happened to this day. So fortunately, a year or so ago, a fellow who had been a kennel manager for the Lombards, or had been their chief kennel help at the end, came down to my house, and he brought me a few more books. Some of the missing years turned up. He brought me some more pictures and so forth, because Louise had given me a tremendous repository of Photographica. And I have some things to flesh out. Plus which, when they gave me, when she gave me all of this stuff out of the place that she was either going to, she told me, it's either going to go to the dump or you're going to take it. I have many of his talks. He was asked to speak. He was president of a number of organizations, New England Sled Dog Club, Siberian Husky Stuff, the International Sled Dog Racing Association. It goes on and on. And he presented talks to people, and I have those manuscripts from what he had presented. It's time for those to come out, I think, and be represented. And I think that people need to have some another book in front of them. So, I guess I better get doing it. Nobody else is doing it, so that they can remember just what a great couple, what a great man he was, but what a great couple they were. Again, a super, super sportsman, super competitor, never lost sight of the love of his dogs and the fellowship in the race and absolutely terrific sportsmanship. And when he went to Alaska, and this is something Dick Moulton told me, he said, you know, he'd pull up in his truck, sit there, you know, next morning they were going to train and everything. Did he get to lay down and rest at night? No. People lined up to his truck. They needed vet care. They needed advice. This was dispensed. Medicines were dispensed. Vet expertise was shared. Dogs were treated. There was never a bill. And he did this willingly.
That's amazing, and especially for people, of course, that he didn't know and or he was possibly racing against.
Exactly. And, you know, there was never, ever in any of these, when he wrote in the date books, you know, there would be the accounts of the training right at the race grounds and the races. There was one account that he did write, and I didn't publish the man's name because I knew that Doc would not want that. There was one person who actually did tried some underhanded stuff to try to mess him up on a trail. But, you know, he didn't. He just said, you know, he just was very matter-of-fact about it. When he lost, and sometimes he lost, you know, and he had some horrible things happen to him. You know, he had dogs take off. He ended up going all over Anchorage one time with a leader that just would not, absolutely would not. It was like the devil had gotten into the dog, take the commands that he was given, and ended up in a used car lot and the gang line got caught on bumpers, and oh my God, you can't imagine the things he went through. So what does he say about it? He's at one of the banquets later, and he says, well, you know, I think I can run for road commissioner now because I know all the streets. So, you know, he always had a sense of humor about himself. He always kept that in perspective. Amazing person.
And you know, getting back to the books and things that haven't been written about him, when my daughter and I came up here to Alaska the first time, we stopped by the Iditarod headquarters right here in Wasilla. And there are tons of books in there written about, you know, all of the great Iditarod mushers of the day. But, unfortunately, there aren't very many people in there that have never run the Iditarod. It's, you know, this sport, unfortunately, has taken on the Iditarod mantra, so to speak. And if you aren't running the Iditarod, who cares? And that's unfortunate.
Well, you know, people tend to look down their noses at sprint racing now because of the Iditarod has taken on so much of a presence. And I'm delighted about that. I helped present that. I mean, I've written tons and tons and tons of words to promote the Iditarod as well, but sprint racing is nothing to sneeze at, and you know, again, you get into the politics. Even George Atla ran the Iditarod to try it to see what was going on or what it was like, you know, and the sprint racing is really the foundation of all of sled dog racing. So there's a place for all of it, and of course now we're evolving into different kinds of races and the stage races and so forth. That's wonderful. There's room for it all. And my feeling was always, especially with the publicity, that the publicity that one race got was good for all the other races. And people should keep that in mind. If you, you know, if it hadn't been for the sprint racing, there wouldn't be an Iditarod, really.
And that's right. And even Jeff King, you know, four-time Iditarod winner, he ran the Fur Rondi races this year down in Anchorage. I think it was this year. It may have been last year.
Mm-hmm.
And he did, I guess he did quite well going from, you know, Iditarod-type mushing to sprint racing here in,
mm-hmm.
in Anchorage.
That doesn't surprise me. That doesn't surprise me because a good dog is a good dog is a good dog. And I have, of course, you know, there's the Iditarod veteran dogs. They know how to space themselves and to time themselves and so forth, and that's part of it. But I can tell you this, that if Doc Lombard was a young man and still with us, he'd be running the Iditarod, too. He wouldn't be able to stay away from the adventure, I'm sure.
I think so, too. So what year did he finish up? What year was his last year of running races?
He was racing into the 80s, and he had some times, and he was beginning to have some events that happened. They had terrific tangles and some really tragic, you know, tangles and stuff. And that was probably getting up to the, you know, the early 80s. By then he had such a reputation. His reputation was such, he was always tinkering, and he was trying to decide if he wanted to shorten up his tug lines. And so he stopped, and he's at a race site, you know, and he's looking at his tug lines, and he says, well, you know, I really don't want to race with them that long. I've been thinking I'm going to shorten them up. So the only way to shorten them up overnight was to tie a knot in them. And so that's what he did. He tied a knot in the tugs and shortened them up the way he wanted and so forth, and he raced with his dogs, and everything was fine. Comes back next year. Every team that comes to the line has knots in the tug lines.
It's like a kid wearing the shoes that they see on TV.
Exactly. People watched him. They emulated him. And all the time that they were watching him and envying him and trying to be like him, they never realized that the biggest component of his team was sitting back at the truck waiting for him, and that was, of course, Luis.
Right, right. And it's always good to have that partner, that handler, that you know, that biggest fan there to help support you.
Yep. Charlie Belfer told me once, of course, you took anything that Charlie told you sometimes with a little grain of salt, that that why Doc did so well was that Louise would do her rosary beads. She was praying the whole time. And he says, that was an unfair advantage, you know. But Harris Dunlap said, well, you know, when Doc was out on the trail, Louise would knit. And she'd knit and she'd knit and she'd look over, you know, where's Doc coming back? We'd watch him, you know, the line. And the longer Doc was out on the trail, if he began to be too long out on the trail, Harris said, those knitting needles are flying faster and faster and faster. And she probably was the only thing that kept her from jumping up and down and pacing, you know, was she was knitting. But
made many a quilt on those race sites, huh?
Well, I'll tell you, there are some instances in the journals when he says, you know, that he took a beating. You know, in other words, he fell, he got hurt.
Right.
But that's always, I mean, it's minimal. Or they, you know, Louise would be training because Doc had flu or something like that, you know. They really pushed themselves frightfully hard. It was a tough existence, the way they lived life. And, you know, a lot of us wouldn't like it. But for them, it was what they wanted to do, and it worked very well for them. The courage and the sportsmanship and the drive and the stick-to-itness and the thoroughness and the everything. It's very seldom that you have a person or a couple that have all of those increments wrapped in one package, you know, the way that they were.
Right, right. And when did he pass, Nancy? What year was that?
Hold on a minute. I can tell you. Got it right here in the book. I want to say 1990. It might have been 1991. But it was just about then, yeah. I believe it was 89 that I took the picture of him when he was at his kennels and the old dog was seated beside him, and it was, you know, it was a love affair. Yes, he died October 10th, 1990, and Louise lived 9 years longer. She died in 99.
Okay, okay. And you said that that their son had passed on from an ATV accident?
Yes. They had an adopted son, Roland, and he was riding an ATV there at the kennels. There was a part coming up, came up a sand, you know, almost like a sand pit from down where the marsh was, and he was riding it up and the ATV up and down the sides of the sand pit, and then he flipped it and it fell on him and killed him.
So what about the, you know, the ongoing legacy of the Lombards, you know, in their dogs and things from that people can still kind of latch onto? You know, people always say that they have Cephalalion dogs going back from, you know, to the 30s or 40s. Is there anything like that with the Lombard dogs that you know of?
Well, I tell you, it would be hard for me to say. The Alaskan Huskies that he was breeding at the end, they got decimated out into a lot of the New England kennels. So I'm just not really sure whether his particular line, and you know, if there's anybody that can say, well, these are Igloo Pack dogs. Now, in the Siberian lines, of course, where you have the pedigree has been preserved and so forth, Igloo Pack is a name in Europe, in the Scandinavian countries, that is still revered. And yes,
right.
I would say that probably over there they're breeding really hard. And that's where my book goes. My book goes to France and Norway and Sweden and Finland now. And those people are preserving that Igloo Pack heritage in their Siberian Huskies.
And, you know, speaking of the Europeans, you know, early this decade, they were the ones that were, you know, pretty much sweeping it up in the Iditarod until Lance Mackey came around and he just started beating the snot out of everybody. But they really had it going on. They were winning the Iditarod very, you know, in very fine fashion until, you know, another big legacy name came onto the scene and really started doing it well. So I think that the Europeans have what it takes, and I think that they know what they're doing. It's just a little bit different type of mushing over there than it is here.
Oh, yes, it is. Yeah, it is. And but I think that to give Lance Mackey his due, I think that Lance Mackey has a lot of Roland Lombard in him, too. He's got
to have
a lot of the same traits. I mean, he's just so good. But, no, they do. Their races over there are fantastic. They're really tough. And they're probably their local regional races are a lot more competitive than what, for instance, I see here in New England. And some of that's due to the weather, yes. But I don't, you know, I'm not sure. I haven't been out to the west and seen the races in Colorado and so forth. But your local regional races, if you've got a real high level of competitiveness, it's going to produce your champions. Now, that's what happened with New England for a while. That's one of the New England and Eastern Canada. We had some great winter weather for decades, and we produced, you know, this region produced some terrific competitors. They went to Alaska and did really well. I mean, look at Jean Breyer goes out there and wins the Women's North American, you know. But we did have some an era of really top competitors. When the weather began to get iffier and iffier, we aren't producing those kinds of people anymore. I mean, I think you have to have the environment. You got to have the crucible, you know. If you have the crucible, then you can put the flame to it, and you can distill this kind of championship. But it's very hard to do that right now in New England. We don't have the trails that would produce it. In Europe, I think they do.
And, you know, speaking of New England, I haven't been up there in a long time, but it's a little hard to think about how you can have a very successful mushing circuit in such a populated area. Literally, there are people everywhere.
Well, they depend, for instance, Laconia depends a lot on the lake because they can keep the snow on the lake, you know, and obviously they don't got houses and roads out on the lake. So when we get a thaw that hits Laconia, the lake goes underwater. I mean, everything that's melted on top and it becomes a bath for the dogs. I've watched teams come in really, really wet, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So you have an area that is absolutely grown in so much that it's hard to get the kinds of trails that you need to produce those kinds of runs.
Right. So we have a few minutes left, and I want to talk to you just a little bit about kind of what's going to happen next with the Siberian, if you can kind of think about that. As you know, as I said, I'm trying to run the Iditarod with Siberians, and there's a few people that run the race with Siberians, one lady in particular that does quite well, and then it just so happens that neighbors on both sides of me have Siberian kennels, so I'm kind of in great company here at our new home. So what do you think now about the Siberian itself, not necessarily with the Iditarod, but them as sled dogs in general?
Well, they are sled dogs. I mean, that's what they were bred for. But they're, you know, the Siberian was always bred also for it was bred for a dog that you were going to drive from one place to get to the other place, not necessarily in a race.
Right.
And I don't mean, I'm not negating their speed. What I'm saying is that there's a little bit in a Siberian of holding back survival, maybe. The Siberian needed to get the person to the next safe place, not necessarily in the fastest fashion. And I think that Siberian holding back a little bit is one of the things that you have to overcome. Now, this is one thing that Doc looked for very hard in his sprint dogs, a Siberian that would have the attitude. And I think in the Iditarod, it's a wonderful race for Siberians if you're considering conditioning, you know, what kind of condition the dogs are going to come in, how can they hold up, and so forth. But really, if you're looking at them to give all of their speed for that particular distance, then I think what you've got to do is find exactly the way to train for it. And
right.
That will be when Iditarod racer has exactly trained their good Siberian team in exactly the right way, then they're going to finish much higher than you've seen.
Do you follow what I mean?
I don't know if I sound confusing.
Yes, exactly. For example, in this year's race was won in 9 days and 23 hours, I believe, and the fastest Siberian who broke the Siberian record was 11 days plus, so mm-hmm. 2 days behind the leader, and that just goes to show you how much faster either Lance Mackey's team's dogs are, or like you said, how much the Siberians are holding back, considering it's a two-day difference in the two teams.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see where the Siberians take us in the near future. I know there's a lot of great Siberian mushers out there, but a lot of mushers still kind of put their thumb up to thumb their noses at Siberian racers that are still trying to do this because they have such a prejudice against them because of that show dog politics and things like that.
Well, yeah, like what I was mentioning with the holding back, that doesn't have anything to do with show dogs. That has to do with being a product of Siberia, a product of the frozen north. I mean, if the dog blew himself out and died, you know, on the trail, it's not a good thing for survival. The
exactly.
thing about, you know, I run hunting dogs. My hunting dogs, I have to be very careful. They will kill themselves in the field. they'll keep going way beyond what you would want them to go because they will overheat and so forth if it's too warm a day. So I've got to be the responsible person to watch because they're never going to say, okay, now time to lie down in the shade. They're going to say, another field, maybe there's birds, let's go. It's a difference in attitude, and that has been bred into the Alaskan because of that attitude of go, 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 go. That's great, but it's not going to keep you alive on the trail, needless to say. It's a, you know, you've got to weigh that, and you've got to train the Siberian. You've got to pick your Siberians, and again, train for the race.
There you go. So, Nancy, we have 2 minutes left. How do people find out more about you? Can we still buy your book, et cetera?
Well, I publish the book. When I start to run out, I publish a few more copies, and sure enough, every once in a while, somebody emails me from Australia or France or something and say, gee, I just heard about the book and I'd like to get it. It's a great reference book. It's called The Training and Racing Journals of Roland Louise Lombard. And if they look me up on the net, Nancy Cowan and Sled Dog Racing, they almost always find a way to contact me. I have an email address. It's falconers@comcast.net, and that's falconers@comcast.net. And I'm, you know, I ship the book off, and everybody's happy. It's a book you really need to read. And if you have known Doc, you will hear his voice when you read the letters. I did. It was eerie. But if you didn't know Doc, it'll open your eyes. It really will open your eyes. And it won't necessarily open your eyes to having better racing dogs. It will open your eyes to being a better racer.
There you go. Nancy Cowan, it's been a pleasure. Maybe we'll have you on again soon to talk about the next legacy in sled dog history. And we'll put a link on our show page to you as well. Nancy, thank you very much. We'll talk to you very soon, okay?
Thank you, Robert. I enjoyed it.
Thank you. Have a good evening.
You too. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. That was Nancy Cowan, the author of Doc Lombard's book, The Training and Racing Journals of Roland and Louise Lombard. And I have to tell you what, that is one heck of a reference book, and if you're a new musher or even a veteran musher, it is something that you have to pick up. I've had it for several years, and I just love sitting back and reading some of the old stories of one of the greatest mushers ever known. Next week on the show, we're going to start back our Mushing Legends segments, and hopefully we'll have Michelle back on. We're still dealing with some episodes of technical difficulties with Skype and GarageBand, but we'll make it work pretty soon. So just bear with us and sit back and enjoy the shows. And we welcome your comments and suggestions. Please send them to live@dogdoctorradio.com. Until next week, this is Robert Forto. Never forget your dreams. We'll see you next week. Goodbye.